Welcome to Empowered, Mind Body Inspiration. The mind is the map to wholeness, wellness, health. The heart is the key to genius and inspiration. Join me and my guests as we explore how to release and rewire into who you truly are, unique, whole, and empowered. Please like, share, and subscribe. Spiral up, spiral out. Welcome, everyone. Today we have Keith Blackmore Noble, author of The Masks We Wear. Keith is an award-winning international speaker who says fear held his life back for decades until one panic attack too many forced him to do something about it. He used NLP and hypnosis to help himself, and I'm sure we're going to get some great tips on how to tackle fear. Let's see how this spirals out. Welcome, Keith.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So good to have you, and all the way from Scotland.
Yes, we're from fairly far north in Scotland.
Yeah, you were saying it's a town that you can be to the coast in 6 miles and in the countryside in a few minutes. That's so beautiful.
I know. We've had 10 minutes drive away, you're at the beach, about 30 minutes drive the opposite direction, and we're starting to get up into the mountains. It's lovely. It's really nice.
Really
not
lovely.
Very populated, but that's part of the attraction.
Yeah, do you love it?
Yeah.
You like it unpopulated and more natural and just all that
being? Yeah. I mean, I've been to a fair few places around the world, and I've lived in big cities and I've lived in villages in almost the middle of nowhere. And honestly, I quite like it fairly relatively sparsely populated. So you've got space. I mean, you've got contact with people and you've got the shops and the amenities, but you've also got plenty of space where you can just be yourself, not be disturbed by other people. You can go out for a nice walk and not bump into other people every five paces. It's nice.
I like it too. I've chosen to be on a farm north of Toronto. Oh,
beautiful. Very nice.
So let's get into your story. Tell us about, you know, you said you were painfully shy and then had one panic attack too many, and then you decided to do something about it. Just tell us all about that. That's so intriguing. And so many, you know, suffer with shyness. We think no one else does.
Oh, yeah.
Right? But actually, most people probably do.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I basically, it goes right the way back to where I was born and grew up. I was born at a very young age. I grew up on a farm in the middle of nowhere in northeast Scotland. It was just me, my mum, my dad, and my sister, and the radio for company. So the first few years, grew up almost in isolation. I kind of got good at interacting with the radio, not so good at learning how to interact with people. Here's a tip for you. Did you know you can't just reach out and retune a person if you think they get boring like you can with the radio? Apparently that's considered rude. But I grew up there, and it wasn't until I was about five that we moved to a village, and that's where I went to school, and that's where I started interacting with people. But by that time, I kind of not really developed the skills of or learned how to interact with people. I was really shy. So shy from a really young age. And that kind of went all the way through school and university and so on. And academically, I did well. I got a really good job in working in IT. I loved computers. And that's brilliant for somebody who's shy or somebody who has social phobia, doesn't like, is scared of speaking with strangers. Working with computers is brilliant. And things were going well. And then 12 to 15 years ago, I was in an online community. This was kind of just before things like Facebook and so on really took off. We were in an online community, and we all kind of got to know each other. And at the time, I was living down near London. I was about half an hour away from London. And it was December, and somebody in the group suggested, "Hey, lots of us live near London. Why don't we all go into London, get together, and have a Christmas party. And before then, if somebody had suggested, let's meet up for a Christmas party, my immediate reaction would have been, oh, I can't, I've got other things to do. Basically come up with any excuse not to go, because being in a room full of people you don't know is, it's kind of my idea of, it was my idea of hell. But I thought, you know what? Let's go, because I know these people. We've been chatting away on the computers for months. I know these people. It'll be fine. How hard can it be? Turn up at the party, and I discover exactly how hard it can be, because what I'd not factored in is, it's one thing chatting away via text behind a keyboard and screen where you can reply in your own time and so on. It's something altogether different when you're actually there with people, people you've never met before, and having interactive conversations. It was walking into a room full of strangers again. And I could feel a panic starting. I went and locked myself in a cubicle in the gents, just while I was heart pounding, you know, the sweats, feeling awful. It lasted for nearly half an hour, the whole panic attack. And once it kind of subsided a bit, I then fled from the venue and I ran all the way down to Waterloo train station. It was the train station for me to get home. And that was maybe about a mile. I ran for a mile. Anybody who knows me knows I don't run. I'm not built for running. I don't run. There's never any point to run. There'll be another bus in a minute. It's a walk. in such a panic that I ran. I didn't even stop to get my coat from the cloakroom, because that would have meant speaking to someone. So I lost a really nice jacket. I just show you how crazy it was. I was sat on the train and I couldn't calm down until the train pulled off. Where my mind was going, in case somebody had seen me left and they'd followed me and they were going to drag me back to the party, which is crazy. But when you're in that state, that's how you start to think. Train was pulling out from the station. I was calming down. I was like, oh, I'm safe. Yes. Okay, I'm going home. And it was then that I remember really clearly thinking, wait a minute, Keith. You can't go on through life like this. Think about it. What is your life going to be like in 5 years' time if you don't change anything? It sucks now. It's going to suck just as much, if not worse, then. 5 years, 10 years, if you don't do something, it's going to be just as bad. You're going to be doing this for the rest of your life, running away, panics, isolating yourself. You can't go through life like this anymore. You've got to do something. And that was the point at which I realized, you know what, something has to change. Because by that point, I was in my 40s. It's like, this is ridiculous. A man in his 40s fleeing from a party because he doesn't know people there. You can't go through life like this. That was the point at which I decided something had to change.
Wow, eh? So, yeah. So you were running from a lion for a mile.
Yeah, that's pretty for a crazy, long time, many years.
Yeah, you'll never forget it. And do you remember, like, any of the thoughts? Like, people will judge me or think something, or, like, do you remember what, or maybe when you went through your hypnosis, you saw it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a combination of thoughts. It was scared because, how can you have a conversation with somebody you don't know? I won't know. What if I don't know what to say? What if we start having a conversation and I then run out of things to say, and we're going to be there in silence? And what are they going to think of me? They're going to judge me. And what if they ask something I can't answer? All this stuff going on. And it was just getting more and more and more scared. And terrified is not too strong a word, to be fair. It really was that frightening and that scary.
Yeah.
And looking at it from with hindsight, it was also ridiculous, because you run out of conversation. Yeah, so what? That's what happens. It happens in all conversations. And so somebody will either say something or you go, well, this has been nice. I'll catch you around and find someone else to talk to. But when you haven't kind of learned those from a young age, it just feels so alien. It's like, I don't know what to do. And that's really, can be really scary and debilitating.
Yeah. Well, you're not alone. And you must have met lots that have been like that since, right? Since you actually talked about how you felt. Yeah. I've had quite a few patients that have that just total fear of being in a crowd or at a party or, you know, and it makes no sense. Like when you see it, but it's so scary for you. And
it is. And here's the crazy thing. You're right. There are so many people and you don't realize that these people are scared. I mean, a few years after I sorted all my stuff out and completely conquered, I'm fine. I love walking into a room full of strangers and leaving a room full of friends because it's great to meet all these new people. I love doing that now. So a few years after I sorted all that stuff and started doing what I do now, I kind of posted on Facebook my story and that whole thing about how I was painfully shy and growing up and all of that. And I had comments from a few friends who'd known me from way back in childhood, and they were all saying, I never realized you were shy. Because when you get to know somebody, you're fine and you're open up and hey, it's all good, but it's getting to meet strangers. So they never even realized it. And over time, I've met, as you can imagine, quite a lot of people who they are shy or that they have social phobia or social anxiety or any of those things. And it's people you wouldn't realize. I mean, I've spoken with some people who I knew for a very long time, who I would kind of look up to and go, oh, I wish I was like them. I wish I could have their sorts of confidence. Turns out they were exactly the same. It's yes, they're really confident in chatting when they know people, but when they don't know them, they're the same. So it's probably more of us feel that way than we might realize.
Yeah. So what was your first steps? How did you recover from this?
It was, call it coincidence or whatever you want. I have no idea. I'm just glad it all happened. I don't care how or why. But a couple of months later, there was a personal development weekend seminar in London. And a friend of mine had been to one before that was run by the same person. And I knew that they'd got a lot from it. And they said, hey, the event's running again. Do you want to come along? I was thinking, there's okay, you're going as well, yeah? They said, yeah, I'm going. Do you want to come along? Yeah, okay, well, we'll get a cheap hotel room where we'll kind of bunk down there. We'll go to the event. So I went to the event. It was like a Friday evening through to a Sunday night. So it was like 2.5 days. So we got there on late on the Friday afternoon, early evening, checked in at the venue, checked in at the event. We were waiting for the main doors to open so you could go in. And there were hundreds and hundreds of people. It was a big event. And I was looking, we were waiting to get in. So I was looking through the book, the workbook that we got. I turned to the back and I saw something which made me freeze. It was a page marked Network Connections. With name, phone number. So it's clearly so when you meet people, you can record their name and phone number and you can catch up with them later. I could feel the panic starting. I was like, oh, you mean I've got to speak with strangers and get their details? I can't do this. So I turned to my friend and said, I can't do this. I'm going back to the room. You go in, enjoy yourself. I'm going back to my room. And they said, look, I promise I will not leave. I will be with you by your side through the whole thing. You promise? Absolutely. Okay, well, I'll do this evening bit, but I'm not promising to do any of the rest of it. We'll see how it goes. Got in there and it was fine. It was good. It was really good, actually. And it's one of those ones where their aim was to sell you into their training programs, which is why they did the 2.5 day free event. It's absolutely fine. And I got a lot from the free bits that they did, the various tasters and so on that they did. But to the point where I was thinking, this stuff works. And so there was one particular event that happened in it that made me really go, this stuff really works. Huh. And I saw the trainings they were offering. They were basically selling their courses to train you as a coach, hypnotist, NLP speaker, all that sort of stuff. So I decided, you know what, I'm going to go for this. And me being me, I bought the full package, the whole thing. I thought, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do the whole thing. Just thinking I would use this to sort myself out and then carry on my IT career. So from that event where I made some changes, I then learned coaching, NLP, hypnosis. And the beauty of being on those courses was you get taught a module, you then go into groups of two or three, and you work on it with each other. So basically, it's a few weeks of free therapy as well, which is fantastic. And that's got me on the road, conquered my stuff about not being able to speak with strangers, started conquering all of these things. And that's what led me down the path that on now. That was really, really enjoyable, really interesting.
Great. Fascinating stuff. Yeah. It's funny, right? The stuff that we have to, some of our biggest hurdles become the biggest gifts as well. So, you know, it led to almost a whole different life, didn't it?
Well, yeah, because I mean, I was still working in IT at that point. And when I was on the, courses, I after a while, I started to notice something. Every time we would do a session together, whoever I was working with would be going, "Oh, you're good at that." And I would sort of go, "Yeah, you're really good as well." Thinking that's just the sort of thing people say to cheer each other on and motivate each other. After a while, I started noticing, not everybody's saying it to each other, but everybody I work with says it to me. I wonder, maybe I am quite good at this. And I was really enjoying it. By the time I finished it, I told friends what I'd been doing. And I had a few friends who were saying, "Oh, that's cool. Can you use that to help me with X, Y, and Z?" Yeah, no problem. Let's do it. So help friends conquer their fear of spiders, help friends lose weight, help friends stop smoking, all that sort of stuff. And I was starting to think, you know what? I've been in IT for a long time and I'm starting to get a bit fed up of it. I don't know whether it's just because I'd been in it for so many years, 20 years, or whether it was office politics or whether I just changed. But I was starting to get a bit fed up of it. I was thinking, you know, it would be lovely to do this as a career, but I had a high paid IT job. I had the outgoings that went with it. I was really high up in the IT organization. I had people working for me in multiple continents. So I had the salary that goes with it, and I had all the outgoings that go with that as well. It was like, I can't afford to quit my job and start up as a coach. I lose the house. I would make money. Oh, what do I do? I guess I'll just stick with IT. And then the most amazing stroke of luck, I got a call from my boss, who happened to be my boss was in the US, but he would fly over to the UK from time to time. He flew over unannounced one time. So we were there in the meeting, and then I got called into the room with him and the director of the site and the HR director. I was told, "Sorry, Keith, because of the financial situation, we're having to make some cuts. Your position is being made redundant. Basically, here's a wheelbarrow full of cash. Go away and never come back." Oh, wow. And at that point, it never even occurred to me, I wonder if I could get another IT position somewhere. I could maybe save that cash, pay off a bit of the mortgage and find another IT position. My immediate thought was, right, I'm going to become a coach. This money will tie me over until I build things up. And I haven't looked back. That's what I've been doing ever since. And that's been an adventure which has taken me to many places around the world. And now I'm back home up in Elgin in northeast Scotland, which is 15 miles away from where I grew up. So, it's kind of taken me home the long way around, as it were.
Right. And,
so that was quite a few sets of coincidences. But I guess, is it coincidence or is it just being in the right place, the right mindset to take advantage of the opportunities that always come along anyway?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty extraordinary, though.
Oh, so yeah. That's been good.
Tell us. Tell us about hypnosis and NLP. Is that how, where you notice the biggest change in how you help a lot of others?
Yeah. So mostly I use NLP, but usually when I tell people what I use, I mention hypnosis. Main reason for that being more people know what hypnosis is than what NLP is. So if say, oh, you're going to use hypnosis to help me. Oh, okay. And then we talk, they're happy to talk about their issue, their problem, that whatever they want to change. But if you say it's NLP, then the conversation becomes, oh, what's that? And you end up talking about what that is rather than exploring how to help them. But it's a great question you asked. So I'll share you a little bit about the two of them. They are kind of related. They both do the same sorts of things. It's all about enabling us to work directly with the person's unconscious mind, mm-hmm. because that's where everything happens. That's where all change happens, at the unconscious. Our unconscious, its main job is to keep us safe, keep us alive, look after us, protect us, and help us get the things we want. But its primary function is keep us alive, keep us safe. That's an evolutionary thing, because if it didn't do that, we'd have died out millennia ago. And our unconscious is kind of lazy in a way. It doesn't want to work things out from first principles every time. So it builds up this big, big, big rule book. Anytime something happens, it kind of notes down what happened and how we reacted and what the result was. So in future, if we encounter that situation, it checks the rule book to see what happens. I mean, that's why you don't have to learn how to walk every morning when you wake up. You just know how to walk. It means we learn from everything that's going on in life. Sometimes we learn well. Sometimes we kind of don't learn the best possible outcome. We do the best we can with what we have at the time, but with hindsight, that might not be the best. I mean, for example, maybe you're really young and a spider drops on you and you freak out. You learn that these spiders are really scary because our unconscious mind goes, oh, yeah, the spider, that freaked the heck out of us. That was really scary. Ah, so anytime you see a spider, you go on red alert, you get terrified. That's not the best, not really the best thing you could have learned. I mean, yeah, the spider dropped on you. It didn't hurt you, didn't harm you. You were absolutely fine. Those are more positive things to learn. But in the moment, well, we kind of don't learn then. So with hypnosis and NLP, it's all about helping the unconscious mind to change that rule book or to install new software, if you want to use a computer analogy. It's basically just changing the sets of rules. So with hypnosis, which has been around for literally centuries, if not millennia, it's all about getting you into what's called a state of trance. And the reason we do that is from about the age of seven, we develop this filter. Before the age of seven, you accept everything unquestioningly. From about the age of seven, we develop this filter. Things come in, and this filter goes, do we believe that? Yes, okay, I'll accept it. No, okay, reject it. Which is why you could tell a three-year-old about this jolly chap in a red suit with a big white flowing beard who comes down the chimney every Christmas and gives presents to all the good boys and girls. And they all believe it with wide-eyed wonder. Oh, I hope I'm good. Oh, I can't wait for Santa to come. If you were to tell a 30-year-old about that, they would kind of think you've maybe been having one drink too many. It's like, yeah, whatever, because it just doesn't fit in with their belief or their model of the world. Which is why, for many people, things like affirmations tend not to work, because if you keep saying to yourself, I'm worthy, I'm successful, but you believe that you're not, you're going, I'm worthy. No, we're not. I'm successful. No, we're not. We're a failure. So it never goes into the unconscious. You're kind of beating yourself over the head with this thing. It's just not going in. They work beautifully. If you do believe that you're successful, then they work really well because you're reminding yourself. But if you don't believe it, it won't work. So with hypnosis, when you're in trance, that filter is kind of switched off, which means when we're speaking directly with the unconscious, it's all going straight in. And the unconscious can work with it. Now, people often say at that point, oh, I knew it. It's brainwashing. You can make somebody do anything. No, you can't. Absolutely not. No hypnotist can make anybody do anything. All you can do is offer suggestions. And if the person's unconscious is prepared to accept the suggestion, it will accept it. If you offer them a suggestion that's against their morals, against their better judgment, they're just, it's just not gonna go in. What trance feels like is, have you ever been reading a book or watching a film or TV program and you're just so engrossed in it? You're reading the book. Oh, what happens next? What happens next? Oh, and you're so engrossed in it. It's kind of like you're in the world that book is. You forget where you are. You forget that you're sat in your chair at home. Somebody walks into the room and says hello, and you're basically, don't creep up on me like that. I didn't hear you come in. If you've ever been in something like that, you're in a state of trance. That's all it is. It's just you're in an intensely relaxed state, focused on a single thing. So with hypnosis, we guide somebody into trance and then offer them suggestions to help them get what it is that they actually want. So, for example, if you're using hypnosis to help someone quit smoking, they want to quit smoking. They just don't know how. So with trance, you're offering their unconscious suggestion, hey, you want to quit smoking? You could do this. You could do this. How about doing this? And your unconscious goes, yes, I'm going to do that. Brilliant. Because it had never occurred to it before, but you're offering it the suggestions. Which is why if somebody didn't want to quit smoking, you offer them all those suggestions, you go, why would I want to do that? I like smoking. I'm going to carry on smoking. So you can't make anyone do anything. So that's hypnosis. NLP, it stands for Neuro-Linguistic Programming, which is quite a big mouthful and was actually just a made-up name. There's a story apparently about Richard Bandler, one of the co-creators of NLP, was stopped and asked by somebody sometime what he was working on. He happened to glance over at some books he had, and three words that jumped out at him were neuro-linguistics on one of them, neuro on one of them, linguistic, and he had a book on programming. He said, neuro-linguistic programming, that's what we're working on, just to give it a name. it's speaking with the unconscious, but without putting you into trance, without guiding you into trance. You can kind of think of it as working with the unconscious in the unconscious's own language. Now, I don't mean your unconscious speaks French and you speak English. I don't mean that. But our unconscious works in pictures, sounds, touch, tastes, smells, feelings, all of the senses. And that makes sense when you think about it. The senses are how we gather all the information about our world. That's what our unconscious works in. So, which means language, such as what we're using at the moment, is just an approximation of what's going on. It has to translate it, and it's approximation. But when you work using NLP, you kind of work with the unconscious in its own language, get it imagining things, get it using pictures, sounds, touch, taste, smell, all those sorts of things to change the way it represents the world. And that is how it then changes the sorts of behaviors that you get. And I can give you a really, really quick example. There's a thing called anchors. This is work that came from, based on work by a gentleman called Anton Pavlov. Does that name ring any bells? Ring any bells? Suit yourselves. He's the guy who rang the bell and made the dog salivate every time he rang the bell. That's called an anchor. Because what happens is we have a stimulus, something happens, and something else happens, and we kind of associate the two. For example, if you hear a piece of music and that just brings some memories flooding back, that's an anchor, because that music happened at the time of those memories, and it means when you hear that piece of music, it just brings that memory flooding back. So that's kind of where a very, very simple example of how NLP can work. You can associate things, you can use that to encourage the unconscious to change the way it stores and represents stuff. Hopefully that all made sense. It wasn't complete rambling jargon.
It made total sense to me. I study with a homeopath that works in exactly the same way, finding the program in the unconscious, using the five senses. How it records is through the five senses. So you have to talk its language. So I'm just loving what you're saying. And and there's a connection to the physical as well, because if there's that anchor and, you know, the program, and you react into a very stressed way to something on it, often it affects the physical body. Do you find that?
Yeah, because that can really show itself with things like phobias. If somebody has a phobia of something, they see the thing, that tiny core part of the brain whose function is basically, will that kill me or not? If that's going to kill me, put us on red alert so that we can deal with it. That part sees the spider, which it has learned it poses a threat, even though we know they don't. Something happened which taught it that was a threat. It hits the red alert button. We go on to red alert. The adrenaline starts pumping to get us ready to fight or run for our life, the fight or flight response. That causes us to breathe faster, to get more oxygen in the blood. The blood pumps faster to get all that oxygen to the muscles, get us ready. So we have that really intense physical reaction. Of course, what happens is the conscious part takes longer because it's got more processing to do. By the time the conscious goes, oh, wait, that's a spider. You know what? They're harmless. They can't hurt us. By the time that's happened, we're already on red alert. We've already got the adrenaline going through. And you can't switch the adrenaline off instantly. It's now in the body. It's going to take time to flush out. You can't switch it off instantly, which is why you can't logic yourself out of an emotional situation, because the emotions happen so fast. Logic takes a bit longer to process because it's a higher, more complex function. And that's why sometimes you can get, we talk about fight or flight, that's why sometimes you freeze, because part of your mind is going, that's dangerous, that could kill us, kill it or run. Another part of your mind is going, it's a tiny spider, it poses us no threat. And another part of your brain is going, well, you're telling me it's dangerous and I should run. You're telling me, I make your mind up. What do I do? So you end up kind of this state of almost paralyzed. So you've got fight, flight, or freeze. These emotional things and things that happen in the mind have a direct impact on the physical body as it's trying to figure out whether it should fight it, run from it, or ignore it and carry on with life.
Right. And I love the story of, say, a child grew up next to a school and they always ate at the time there was a bell. Right?
Nice, yeah. So
the bell gets anchored to food and saliva and all of that. And then imagine if they moved to a train station and the bell was going off every 15 minutes.
Oh, know, man.
And the same reaction. You're going to get a peptic ulcer and have, or an eating disorder and have no idea
exactly.
Why.
Exactly. Yeah. That's so powerful. And the neat thing is we can actually use these to our advantage. So these anchors, like the ringing of the bell causing Pavlov's dogs to salivate, or the ringing of the bell signaling that it's time for food, causing the person who hears it to want to eat, even though they have no idea why. We can use these in a positive way. For example, you can use a touch or a physical move to anchor in positive states. I mean, you see in films like Wolf of Wall Street, or these films where people are doing the dealing and so on. Every time they get some, every time they win something or make a sale, yes, they do a fist pump or whatever. That kind of anchors it in. So next time when they're going to go in and attempt to make a sale, right, do that first, puts them in the same state as they were when they made the sale. So you kind of feel that positivity. Or, and this is a thing I know a lot of professional speakers do, they kind of anchor, they always step onto the stage with the same foot every time, because they've actually built an anchor around that. The act of stepping on stage with that foot brings them into the positive state that they want, so that no matter how they're feeling backstage, as soon as they step foot on there and hear their music cue, boom, brings them into that state, so they're ready to get out there and perform and do whatever it is in a peak positive state. So again, we can use all these things to our advantage.
Exactly. Cool. So brilliant. Yeah. And how did this all lead to your book, The Masks We Wear?
Great question. That all came about partly by chance, I guess. I, as well as being a coach and a hypnotist, I'm also a speaker and I've done talks around the world. This past year, we had lockdown, obviously, with a global pandemic and lockdown and everything. And there was a network organization that I'm a member of, but living where I do, way, way up in the northeast of Scotland, I never really got to go to physical meetings because the nearest one was like an 8-hour drive or 8-hour return trip by car, which is a long way to go for a breakfast, quite frankly. It would have to be a really special breakfast. So I never made it. But when the pandemic started, they put all of their meetings online. So I was able to fully dive in. And like most most business networking organizations, part of the meeting format is somebody gets to do a talk. In this case, it's like an 18 or 20 minute talk, sharing, it's not a sales pitch, but it's sharing some interesting information or useful stuff or whatever. So I said, hey, right, I'm going to really get involved in this. I want to talk at as many of these events as I possibly can. And I've got a few different talks that I offer, but the first one that I did was a talk which I called 8 Powerful Words, which was built upon a talk I'd done a few years previously, several times. And it went down really well, and it was really popular, and I got asked to do it more and more and more times at more and more events. We get people booking in especially to hear it. I was at one of the meetings, and somebody said, hey, this will be the fourth time I've heard your talk. And I was sort of said to them, oh, I'm sorry. I hope it's not getting too boring. And they went, no, I booked in specially to hear it again because I hear something new every time. And I had other people saying, oh, you should turn this into a book. And there's only so many times before people can say, you should turn this into a book and we'll buy it, before you go, oh, I give up. I will turn it into a book. Obviously, there's a market for it. People want this because, I mean, it's great doing an 18, 20-minute talk, but you can only cover a little bit of the content. So that's where the Mask Through Air came about. It's taking all of that talk and exploring and expanding and going deeper into each of the sections and giving people more information about what they can do. How it's basically all about the masks that we wear, and it is nothing to do with the pandemic. It's nothing to do with COVID. It's the metaphorical masks we wear in life.
Yeah,
so it's all about.
Yeah, like just tell us about the masks that.
Yeah, so it's. I mean, we all go through life wearing masks without even realizing it, and we wear them mainly because we're scared. We're scared people are going to dislike us. We want everybody to like us. So if there's an aspect of us which we think people will dislike, without even realizing it, we kind of hide that bit away. We pretend we're not that person. We start wearing all these masks. But yeah, here's the thing. Throughout the whole history of humanity, nobody has been universally liked. Nobody. Even Christ, Buddha, the Prophet Muhammad, they all had their detractors. And believe it or not, Jane, there are people out there who dislike me. I know it's crazy, right? But there are people out there. We are all people who dislike us. I know, except obviously everyone loves you, Jay. I must pop that in. But we all have people who dislike us.
Oh, yeah.
And that's absolutely fine. But we spend all this time hiding behind these masks, which we think will protect us, but actually it just makes things worse. And so the book is all about what these masks are, where they come from, why they're so dangerous, and how you can go about identifying them, removing them, and what life becomes like when you do remove those masks, and how you can use that to live a really, really powerful life.
Right. So just to be aware. Yeah. And to just be aware that you're doing it is huge. Yeah, right?
It is. That just being aware that masks exist and you are wearing them is a massive step. So many people, I'd say most people, go through their life without even realizing they're wearing these masks. Mm. So even just being aware of it is a massive first step.
Yeah.
Even if you did nothing else, just being aware of that, okay, I'm not being the real me here. Okay, at least I'm aware of it. I may not do anything about it, but I'm aware of it. Even that is a massive step in and of itself.
Well, it takes a lot of energy to be something you're not, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? It's so tiring.
Yeah. Do you have an example of anyone that had, or even yourself, of a mask that, you know, you realized or they realized, and once it was gone, they felt so more authentic?
Yeah, I mean, it's I'll share it with you because it's a story that I share in the opening of the book. To cut a long story short, I grew up pretty shy, as I said. Got to about the age of 25. Growing up in the 70s and 80s, not really many role models, just kind of doing the best I could, hiding every aspect of me that I thought people would dislike, pretending not to be what I thought people would dislike. Reached about the age of 25, got married. First couple of years was great, but after a while we kind of realized married life's not really working out the way I thought it would. It's not the bed of roses we thought it would be. Trying to figure out why it wasn't working, I realized, of course it's not working. I'm actually gay, but I'd spent like 15, 20 years, because of where I grew up and because of what society was like at the time, spent 15, 20 years pretending not to be, hiding all of that aspect, to the point where I'd kind of sort of convinced myself that I was straight. But of course, you can't be who you're not. So I was hiding behind all these masks. And then, of course, it was making things just not work. So that was a massive realization for me. I think that's the first time that I was really aware of masks and the danger of them rather than the power of them. Right. So that's quite a big example. That's not going to apply to most people, but it gives you a kind of idea that there are things where we pretend to be who we're not, or we pretend not to be who we are. And over time, that just causes more and more problems and more damage to us, and potentially damage to others around as well.
And so many times because we want the approval of someone else, right? Yeah, society, exactly. You know, a best friend, a spouse, a parent. So, so many times.
Yeah.
So it takes a lot of courage to take that mask off.
That's the thing, it can take a lot of courage to remove your mask. And yes, there will be people who dislike you. But as we explore in the book, they're going to dislike you anyway sooner or later. Sooner or later, they'll figure something out. The more you get to know someone, the greater the chance of the cracks appearing in the mask or the mask starting to slip. They'll get a glimpse. And if the person under the mask is someone they don't like, they won't like you. And they'll dislike you even more because you've been basically, as they see it, making a fool of them, pretending not to be who you are. They're going to dislike you even more.
Yeah. And sometimes,
when you remove... Sorry, go on.
Yeah. But I was going to say, sometimes you remove the mask and it's not nearly as scary as you thought it would be.
Exactly. I mean, I certainly found that. I eventually plucked up the courage. I mean, I'm really happy to say that things with my wife and I, we split. It was very amicable. We had no children or anything, so it was easy. It was very amicable. We've still remained friends to this day, many, many years later. She's now happily married with a wonderful man. They've got a wonderful life together. Over time, I started kind of going, I suppose I should start telling friends and family. Started coming out. And each time I'd work myself out, going, what are they going to say? And the vast majority of the time, their reaction was, is that it? It was either... was that it? Or, I'd figured that out. It's like, right? You spend all this time hiding behind your mask, people have kind of figured it out anyway. So it's like, I went through all that for nothing. And you're right. Most of the time when we remove our mask, there'll be some people who dislike you. But most people will either, not care one way or the other. Or there will be people who do like that facet of you. And now they can see it. It's like, cool. Hey, you as well. Let's hang out. Let's see what magic we can create together.
Yeah.
And over time, you will start to attract the people who like who you are and what you stand for. So over time, you'll become surrounded by people like you who believe the same things, who think the same things, want the same things, dream the same dreams. And it's a lot less tiring just being you than it is trying to pretend to be somebody else.
Yeah. And when you're so much clearer with who you are, of course, you're going to send out a much clearer message and attract that.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And another crucial thing, as it mentions in one of the chapters, when you do that, you actually give other people permission to be who they are as well. Because they're kind of going, wow, huh, I'm not the only one. Oh, maybe I can vote this way, do this, think this, build that, whatever it is. I'm not the only one. And it creates this ripple effect around the world, giving other people permission, people who you'll never, ever meet, but they kind of get inspired. It's like, ah, so you have such a positive effect on so many lives without ever knowing it. All because you just decided to be you.
and never know how big a ripple you send out. Beautiful. Absolutely. So Keith, that was incredible. Thank you so much. What would you leave people with? What guidance and information would you leave them with?
I think I would leave with one very short phrase, which I often sign off with. And it sounds like a simple phrase, but the more you think about it, the power there is behind it. And that is simply that change is always possible. And when you change your mind, you change your life.
Yeah. And so it can be so simple, like just. It
can indeed.
Yeah. Beautiful. And
it doesn't matter what situation you're in, it is always possible to change. Not always easy, not always simple, but it's always possible.
And it can be in an instant.
A change is instantaneous. It's building up the courage to make the change or deciding what to do. That's what takes time. But change itself is instant. You change and it's changed. And it can have such a profound positive impact on your life and the life of others.
That's a beautiful thing to leave us with. And how do people find you?
Great. They can find me, my website, keithblakemorenoble.com, or just look for Keith Blakemore Noble on any of the social media, or look for Keith Blakemore Noble in your favorite search engine. I'm lucky I'm the only person in the world with this name, which makes it rather easier for people to find me. So yeah, just look up Keith Blakemore Noble. Or go to the website, keithblakemorenoble.com. I love connecting with people. Yeah. So yeah, drop me a line.
Great. And I'll put it in the description as well, so that awesome. It's totally easy. Thank you so much. And for everyone out there, don't forget, don't give away your power to anyone else. Be the creator of your own life. Spiral up, spiral out.